The Senate tries to figure out how to handle a he said, she said involving the Supreme Court nominee.
If you go back to the hearings in 1991 with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, frankly, senators from both sides were portrayed as buffoons.
Is President Trump's tough talk on trade paying off?
People and industries that have been affected by these tariffs in America are willing to give the president some room.
I'm Rachel Sutherland with a look at the politics of natural disasters.
When the devastation of Maria struck, there were already problems. In fact, most of the island didn't have power before the hurricane struck.
It's time to get caught up on what's happened and what's next. With Rachel Sutherland and John Decker, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington. In the very near future, Judge Kavanaugh will be on the United States Supreme Court. That definitive statement was made late this week by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell as he rallied support at the Values Voter Summit here in Washington.
So, my friends, keep the faith. Don't get rattled by all of this. We're going to plow right through it and do our job.
The confidence from McConnell comes at the end of a week that has cast a lot of doubt about Brett Kavanaugh's prospects at winning confirmation, an outcome that seemed all but certain until an accusation made earlier this month, since California professor Dr. Christine Blasey Ford went public, accusing Kavanaugh of pinning her down, trying to remove her clothing, and covering her mouth at a house party while both were in high school in the early 1980s. There's been a high-stakes effort to bring her to Capitol Hill and tell her story to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Kavanaugh wants to return to the committee as well, telling the Senate he'd testify right away to clear his name. For seasoned Capitol Hill reporters, this week has brought back memories of 1991, when a sexual harassment allegation against Justice Clarence Thomas sparked a must-watched hearing and nearly derailed his chances of a seat on the high court. Some senators who were here then are also thinking about that hearing and how it played out and how to avoid similar mistakes. And that is where we'll start this week with our senior Capitol Hill producer, Chad Pergram.
Here would be the timetable. You would have to have what Mitch McConnell would refer to as filing a cloture petition. Now, what that is Congressese for means you're shutting off debate. He couldn't do that to break a filibuster, to file cloture until day number two. Okay, well, cloture petitions by rule in the Senate require one intervening day, a day that the petition lays over. I know this is getting in the weeds, but this is important for establishing this timetable to demonstrate how they might be able to get this done before the 1st of October. So the layover day would be day three. In Senate parlance, the cloture petition would ripen, meaning it's available to be voted on, and then you would have a vote to end debate, to break a filibuster on day four. So that vote couldn't happen until day four. So if they get under the new Senate precedent, remember, it used to take 60 votes to confirm to break a filibuster with the Supreme Court nominee. They established a new precedent in the situation last year, April of last year, with Neil Gorsuch, lowering the bar from 60 to 51. If they get 51 votes in the Senate, then this is on a glide path. Now, you just don't turn right around and have an immediate confirmation vote. There's about 30 hours which are afforded the minority or the opponents to continue to talk or hold things up. And so that would take you into day five, which is where you would have that final confirmation vote. Because if you got 51 votes to break the filibuster, you're certainly going to get 51 votes to confirm the nominee. And that would be late in the day on day five. So let's just say they really got going on this, say, Wednesday of next week or even Thursday. You could see, and there are ways to shorten this up just a little bit, but you could see where they could get this in just under the wire before the first Monday in October, the 1st.
So, Chad, that's the process of all of this, the timeline. But let's talk about the politics, because it has been sometimes challenging, I think, for Republican senators in particular to be asked about this process, given the serious accusation leveled against Brett Kavanaugh.
Absolutely. And that's why, you know, there's a lot of deference that they want to extend to Christine Blasey Ford and take what she is saying seriously, but also take what Brett Kavanaugh, who categorically and defiantly denies that this ever happened. And here, if there's something that actually did happen, listen to what Ford has to say. If something didn't happen, listen to what Kavanaugh had to say. That's what they have to do because, A, there's so much riding on this. It's a Supreme Court pick. Number two, we're just about 5-6 weeks away from the midterm elections, and both parties are very worried about how this could be portrayed if they're viewed as you know, a bunch of 11 men on the Judiciary Committee on the Republican side of the aisle hitting, you know, Christine Blasey Ford, you know, too hard, maybe not taking her seriously. If you go back to the hearings in 1991 with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, frankly, senators from both sides were portrayed as buffoons. There was a lampooning of them on Saturday Night Live, probably one of the four or five best skits in the history of the program that still stands the test of time today about what was going on, you know, at that hearing. And so they don't want to get anywhere near that where the Senate just looks like a circus. I mean, we had a pretty good circus going on around here, you know, just a couple of weeks ago at the start of his confirmation hearings. This would be, you know, sort of a grand carnival.
And so that's the challenge. The other thing is, and we've talked about the math, obviously, even before Dr. Ford came public with this story, but, you know, 51-49, it could come down to just a handful of votes between Republicans and Democrats.
I would look at Lisa Murkowski from Alaska. I would look at Jeff Flake, the Republican senator from Arizona. Somebody else who, you know, really didn't seem to be in play here, but kind of came in play late the past few days, was Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, she's a fairly moderate Republican. She does represent West Virginia, which is a state which went heavily for Trump in 2016. She's also a graduate of Holton Arms, which is the school in suburban Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C., where Christine Blasey Ford graduated from. And there were alumni from that school who came to Capitol Hill. 1,000 had signed a petition urging senators to listen to Christine Blasey Ford. And I asked one of the alumni what they thought of this and what Shelley Moore Capito should do. And they said, you know, that she should stand with, you know, her fellow graduate from Holton Arms, Christine Blasey Ford. And we don't know if Capito would take that to heart, but that's what, you know, graduates of her school are saying.
You know, you mentioned Capito, you mentioned Flake, you mentioned Collins. All of them have expressed a desire to hear from Dr. Ford. If that happens, when senators hear from Dr. Ford, will that be enough, in your view, to be, will that satisfy sort of what some of these Republicans are asking for?
Does just hearing from them answer all the questions? I mean, rarely have we seen that. You know, usually when you hear from someone in such dramatic circumstances, Jared, you have to have more. And it's not like they hear from Ford, they hear from Kavanaugh, they gavel the hearing out, and then everybody goes and votes. They might say, well, you know, they mentioned this other thing, or they mentioned this other witness who was there. Do they need to have that person in? Do they need to investigate further because something that was unknown heretofore has come forth in that hearing? And McConnell, when speaking Friday to the Value Voters Conference here in Washington, D.C., he said that we're going to plow ahead. Now, plowing ahead might not satisfy the likes of Flake and Collins and Murkowski and maybe some others. So he has to be very careful because he doesn't have, you know, many votes to work with. If he's perceived as plowing ahead and not doing due diligence, he might very well lose those votes, those senators who potentially could vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh.
A lot of questions still remain, and we'll see how all of that plays out. The other thing that we now are wondering, and you sort of predicted this, Chad, is these appropriations bills, which, you know, Republican leaders have been very excited about, that regular order to a certain extent has been restored, and all of these concerns of a government shutdown were going to be put to rest very early in the process. And this week, the United States Senate overwhelmingly passed a couple of spending bills, some funding agencies for the entire fiscal year, and then this sort of stopgap measure to fund the rest of government, at least until after the midterm elections. And all seem to be right with the world. That's going to go to the House next week. And then the president openly questioned on Twitter whether or not he should sign it.
So he has signed the what we're calling the first minibus, which deals with, you know, three of the 12 appropriations bills. Those were the easiest ones, too. So even if there is a government shutdown, it's not going to be a complete government shutdown because they have three of the 12 bills funded. Now, what the Senate moved in the past week and what the House is expected to do in the coming days is an appropriation bill which would fund the Departments of Labor, HHS, and also the military. That gets you well over half of the government funding, the total discretionary dollars. In other words, the dollars, the money that Congress has discretion over spending. And then attached to that is for anything they don't complete, whether it's those other seven bills, there's a possibility they could get up to eight or nine. But if there's anything left on the table by the time they get to October 1st, the government does not shut down. There is an interim bill latched to that piece of legislation that funds everything till the 7th of December. Now, what is not funded at all and is not going to be in this any of these packages is money for the wall. I should say there is $1.6 billion that was agreed to in this March accord that they signed off on. And if the president were to veto this spending bill and say, no, 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 you got to do the wall, then he even loses $1.6 billion for immediate funding in the wall. There's a big question whether or not they could ever go further than that, higher than that. It's unclear, mainly because you need to get to 60 votes in the Senate to overcome a filibuster, and you probably can't even get to 50 votes in the Senate on this.
He would also be vetoing a pay raise for service members.
And that's exactly why, and plus an entire money for the military. That is precisely why Republicans on Capitol Hill don't think that he will veto it. In fact, I spoke with one senior House Republican source who said, you know, you never know with President Trump, but they said, had we not addressed the military, had not done the Pentagon spending bill, and then we're going into this, then the president probably would threaten and probably would shut down the government. So what they did was on Capitol Hill, they made sure that they got the military bill funded, basically daring the president. This is Republicans on Republicans, mind you, here, Jared, daring him to veto that bill because they say at that point, it's not on the Democrats, it's not on the Republicans, it's on one person, President Trump.
There's a lot to watch in the week upcoming, so we will have a lot to talk about next week as well. Chad Pergram, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Remember when President Trump said this to a global audience about North Korean leader Kim Jong-un?
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
That was about a year ago this week at the United Nations General Assembly. President Trump returns to the General Assembly next week. And boy, is what he's saying about Kim Jong-un different now. His Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has made multiple trips to Pyongyang. The president met with Kim in that historic summit in Singapore. And earlier this week, President Trump on Twitter suggested progress with the effort for North Korea to denuclearize. Here's how UN Ambassador Nikki Haley described the year that's been earlier this week.
It is baby steps. It's not going to happen overnight. We knew that. But we can't accept half measures. That would be doing it like previous administrations. Right. We have to do this completely, fully, and we have to do it by making sure we're continuing the sanctions and continuing to hold North Korea's hand to the fire.
This year, it's Iran that's expected to get attention from President Trump, and Haley did not rule out a possible meeting with Iranian President Rouhani, though nothing is planned. Meetings are planned for President Trump with leaders of South Korea, Japan, Egypt, France, Israel, and the United Kingdom. In a news conference earlier this week, alongside his counterpart from Poland, President Trump teased a trade announcement, too, at the UN General Assembly and warned of more tariffs.
We are the piggy bank to the world. We've been ripped off by China. We've been ripped off by, excuse me, Mr. President, the European Union, of which you're a part of. We've been ripped off by everybody. And I want to protect the American worker, the American farmer, the ranchers, the companies.
That response came from a question from our own White House correspondent, John Decker. So who better to bring in for an update on where the administration is on a number of trade deals it hopes to redo in short order? So, John, tell me what the president teed up in response to your question about this forthcoming trade agreement with South Korea.
Well, this is something the president discussed with South Korean President Moon all the way back last November, the idea of some sort of trade agreement between the U.S. and South Korea. And the president indicated that he would likely be signing something along those lines next week at the U.N. General Assembly when he meets face-to-face with President Moon.
This is just one of many different trade agreements that the president has tried to redo in his time in office. Obviously, ongoing talks with Canada to re-enter, I guess, what is formerly known as NAFTA. Where does that process stand right now?
Well, Canada is not a part of the agreement that has tentatively been reached between the U.S. and Mexico, but the U.S. believes that they can get Canada on board before the end of this fiscal year, September the 30th. And so there is a little bit of a deadline fast approaching, a little over a week left to meet that deadline. But talks have been ongoing for over the past month between U.S. trade officials and Canadian trade officials to get them back into sort of, I guess, what you could call NAFTA 2.0.
Is there one issue in particular that seems to be stickier than the others?
There are a number of issues that are issues for both countries. There's the issue of protecting American dairy farmers. They feel they've been very hurt under the current NAFTA trade agreement. And in addition to that, there is the sunset provision. The U.S. would like to have a sunset provision, an expiration date. The Canadians don't. I don't believe the Mexican government wants that either. So those are two major sticking points that have been in play, which prevents or has prevented Canada from signing on to what Mexico has already signed on to in the past few weeks.
I don't know who's been at the receiving end of more tweets, Canada or China, but both seem to be countries that the president has focused a lot of his trade ire towards. Let's talk about where things stand with China, because the president has suggested that some of the progress or lack thereof with North Korea is directly tied to his trade stance when it comes to China. Are those issues really that closely aligned?
Well, I think they could be. You know, China certainly brought North Korea to the negotiating table. There's no doubt about that. And that's why the U.S.-Chinese relationship on all matters was pretty good in the president's first year in office. I had dinner the other night with two senior Chinese officials, and they described the U.S.-Chinese relationship in a not very good place right now. You know, on Monday, tariffs of 10% will be imposed on another $200 billion on imported Chinese goods, and that penalty will actually rise to 25% beginning January the 1st. In China, they'll retaliate with their own tariffs on Monday the 24th with $60 billion of tariffs on U.S. goods. Everything from aircraft, Boeing would be hit hard by that, as well as liquefied natural gas. And so this trade war, for lack of a better term, continues to escalate between the U.S. and China.
Yeah, that's a good point when you talk about where this retaliation is focused on, because there has been attention paid to China maybe hitting some sectors that could be politically difficult for President Trump, for Republicans in the midterm elections.
Well, that's the reason why the president has made some trips to visit with constituents, sort of part of the Trump base that have been hit hard so far by the tariffs. So not only the tariffs the U.S. placed on the EU and then the EU retaliated, but also the tariffs that the U.S. placed on the Chinese and the Chinese retaliated. So the president's traveled to meet with farmers in Iowa. He's traveled to meet with steelworkers in Illinois. And I think that the patience is there, interestingly enough. The people and industries that have been affected by these tariffs in America are willing to give the president some room because they feel that in the long term, this trade tactic by the president will pay off.
The question, of course, is how long it may
That's
take
right.
to get both sides together. And so far, there doesn't seem to be much evidence that either side's, you know, bending at all.
No, that's right. And, you know, what does the president want? You know, I think what he wants, and he saw this with South Korea, he wants to be able to claim victory. It could be a small victory, but just something to essentially save face. And the Chinese want the same thing. There are talks that have been put on hold between U.S. and Chinese trade officials, and there's no word as to whether those talks will resume. But that's a big part of the process, Jared. You know, you need to talk in terms of trying to come to some sort of negotiated settlement, some sort of compromise. And right now, both sides are not talking.
Well, it's certainly trade is part of the greater diplomatic effort. So we will see if there is any progress made in any of these pull-asides, perhaps, that President Trump has next week in New York.
That's right. It's a big part of why the president's heading up to the UN General Assembly. And perhaps there will be some movement on some of these trade issues with the U.S. and our allies, our partners from the EU. But I don't see any type of room for improvement over the course of the next week between the U.S. and the Chinese.
All right, John Decker, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks a lot, Jared. Have a good one.
Live in a state or a congressional district with a competitive race this November? If the answer is yes, you don't need me to tell you we are close, really close, to the midterm elections. Fewer than 45 days to go. Those commercials on TV and radio will only pick up. They may become pretty nasty, too. Which races will be talked about most the day after Election Day? Those surprises where each party overperformed or underperformed and ultimately decided control of the House or the Senate. It is impossible to predict the future, but these two can certainly try to make sense of what November 2018 will tell us about the state of American politics. Chris Anderson is president of Anderson Robbins Research, a member of the Fox News Decision Team, and the Democratic partner on the Fox News poll. Darren Shaw is the director of the Texas Lyceum poll, a member of the Fox Decision Team as well, and the Republican partner on the Fox News poll. Chris, Darren, thanks for coming together to try and make sense of what we may see. And Chris, I will start with you. Where do you think the midterms will be decided?
You know, I think, and this isn't a novel idea, but to a large degree, the midterms are going to be decided by the White House and what people think of what's going on in the White House and whether that leads to, as some are thinking, a rather large blue wave, or if it's more modest. And I think to a large degree, while the Senate races are clearly state by state, driven by individual candidates and state issues, there are so many of these in the toss-up column that appear to be within the margin of error that they'll probably fall one way or the other, and that historically shows that the case is toss-ups don't usually split 50-50. They usually go two-thirds one way or the other. So we all know what that list is: Florida, Indiana, Missouri, North Dakota, Arizona, Nevada, Tennessee. And, you know, I guess the big surprise, and Darren down in Texas maybe wants to talk, what's going on in Texas?
Yeah, no, Darren, let's bring in, because the Ted Cruz, Beto O'Rourke race, I think, has surprised a lot of people. You and I have talked a little bit about this race before. Is this still an advantage for Ted Cruz?
Yeah, I think it is. But the fact that we're talking about the state, I suppose, is the larger story. You know, the latest polls I've seen, of course, I was speaking to my class on Tuesday afternoon after the Quinnipiac poll came out that showed Cruz up 9 points. And I said, well, you know, you haven't seen a poll that actually has O'Rourke ahead. And while the margin has been small, Cruz has been leading in all these. And then the Quinnipiac poll shows what a lot of us think will ultimately happen, and that is these undecideds and kind of recalcitrant Republican voters will ultimately kind of hold their nose and vote for Cruz. And then, of course, 2 days later, there was a Ipsos poll that showed O'Rourke in the lead by 2 points. I think the reality is the average of all the polls out there has Cruz up by about 4 points. I think 4 to 6 points is probably right. But that race is a microcosm where you've got these Republican incumbents out there who have some baggage, even in red states. You know, Chris mentioned, you know, Senate races in Indiana and Missouri and North Dakota and, you know, even Democrats defending in Montana and places like that. But even with a good economy, at least by most accounts, you know, a good economy, no, you know, real foreign policy entanglements dragging down the administration, Republicans are still struggling for oxygen. And I think that's right now, that's the story of the election. Whether it changes or not, we'll see.
The other interesting dynamic I hear a lot is on the economy. And you mentioned that by most accounts, it seems to be doing really well. But there is still uncertainty, particularly when we talk about trade, these tariffs, how that may impact a lot of sectors, especially in so-called Trump country, right? The Midwest, the areas that rely on steel, rely on coal as well.
You know, Chris and I have talked about this. I've had some conversations with other people. I think the economy, the economic recovery has been uneven. It was uneven under Obama, and it's still uneven, although it's kind of tending in a more positive direction overall, I guess. It hasn't touched everybody. And the tax cuts, you know, and some of the polling that we've seen, the reaction to the tax cuts has been lukewarm. People really don't seem to be feeling it in their pocketbooks. And you throw on top of that, you know, Trump excited a lot of people in 2016 by talking about renegotiating some of these trade deals, and he's done that. He's, you know, put them back on the table, but there is a downside, right? There's a downside for consumers. You know, if you renegotiate trade deals with the Chinese or you know, the Indians or some of the or Mexicans and some of these other countries, it can result in higher prices on goods. That's something that scares people. And then there are retaliatory tariffs imposed by some of these other countries that hurt workers in the United States. Hard to say what the balance is right now, but it's complex. And that complexity, I think, is manifest in ambivalence in public attitudes on the economy.
We're seeing that really clearly in polling. In our Fox poll last month, we saw that Republicans think the economy is doing well. Independents and Democrats do not. So how you view the economy is very much through a partisan lens right now. The other thing that I think is really interesting about the economy is that it's not the biggest issue, or it's not even a top issue for a lot of voters right now, where health care is. So in terms of winning back some of the voters who maybe felt like they were being left behind, and that the system wasn't paying attention to them and decided to they'd vote for Trump instead of Clinton, you know, if they're feeling insecurity related to their ability to pay for health care, that is proving to be potentially a much bigger issue in a lot of these races than I think a lot of us expected not too long ago, and creating a situation where the economy is not really providing the tailwind that it should for the party in power when it's doing well, because health care is becoming a bigger issue and there's a lot of anxiety again about health care.
As election night starts to play out in November, and what you guys both will be locked away in that isolation chamber we call the decision room, right?
Oh, it's fun. It's not bad.
We call it the Nerdquarium.
As you were in the Nerdquarium on election night, trying to figure out all of these races coming in, will there be one or two or three or four races in the Eastern time zone you look at that may start to say, all right, maybe there's something happening here?
This gets a little bit in the weeds, but I think it's worth mentioning. I look at Indiana and Florida, and the reason for that is that they close relatively early. So if you're thinking of us, you know, in the Nerdquarium, or your viewers out there on election night who are waiting for those first returns to come in, by the time the polls close in Indiana across the state, we will have seen an hour of data from the Eastern time zone. And so we'll have a good sense from a technical point of view of how well our models are performing and how well the polls are doing. Same with Florida, right, where you've got that Eastern time zone. So we're looking at data while, you know, the normal viewers can't. We'll actually have some data coming in and a sense of, you know, how to characterize those races pretty early on. And those are critical races.
There are some House races all over the country that are not often in play, that maybe are in play this time around. What are some of the ones that interest you the most?
I'm from Texas. Texas 23 is a state where there's a Republican incumbent, Will Hurd. But that's a state, a district that stretches all the way across the border area, all the way up into El Paso. That's a key place where the Republicans need to hold. And then, again, in Texas, a couple of these seats like Pete Sessions' seat and a few others that, boy, by all accounts, they ought to be Republican. You know, these aren't states where, you could argue that the Republicans won by virtue of kind of Trump's vote in 2016. These are district Republicans should win on the basis of their partisanship.
Chris, what are some of the risks for Democrats? Where can they not afford to fall short?
As we all know, in the Senate, it's an incredibly narrow path. So the seats that they hold now, they really need to hold: Indiana, Missouri, North Dakota. And that's not a sure thing by any means. You know, especially North Dakota is looking pretty problematic. You know, one thing that we haven't talked about, another interesting thing that we'll be looking for in Florida, is the Latino vote. There's a lot of issues with getting a good sample of Latinos in telephone polls. But the conventional wisdom has been, well, after everything that's gone on with immigration, Latinos must really be upset with Trump and, you know, moving away from Republicans. It's not all that clear from the data that I've seen that that's the case. So if there's not an ability among Democrats to really take some margin out of Latino areas, especially in Florida, you know, things get more challenging for them.
Chris Anderson, Darren Shaw, both members of our Decision Desk, thank you so much.
They're called acts of God, but when natural disasters strike, people tend to turn to human beings for help, and that includes government officials and the president. I'm Rachel Sutherland with a look at the politics of natural disasters, how presidents respond to storms, earthquakes, and terror attacks can make or break their legacies. We all remember how Hurricane Katrina threatened to sink President George W. Bush, and even 10 years later, he continued to reflect on the storm.
All of us who are old enough to remember will never forget the images of our fellow Americans amid a sea of misery and ruin. We'll always remember the lives lost across the Gulf Coast.
1 year ago this week, Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico. And while the island still works to recover, Hurricane Florence drowned parts of the Carolinas. This time, President Trump is in the spotlight. He made headlines when he cast doubt on a George Washington University study that said nearly 3,000 people died as a result of Maria. The president tweeted, 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. When I left the island after the storm had hit, they had anywhere from 6 to 18 deaths. As time went by, it did not go up by much. President Trump also blamed Democrats for the numbers, saying they were trying to make him look bad. The study was conducted by George Washington University's Milken Institute School of Public Health and was commissioned by the Republican governor of Puerto Rico. Earlier this year, I spoke with a nurse who volunteered in Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Maria. At the time, Harvard researchers had estimated the death count to be close to 5,000. Kathy Kennedy, she's with National Nurses United, told me the high numbers didn't surprise her.
It is all related to this hurricane. If you've ever been to Puerto Rico, I'm sure you've seen pictures. These folks, because of the devastation of that hurricane, whether they died during the hurricane or the aftermath, these people are still without water, food.
Kennedy said she believed the federal government's response was wholly inadequate.
We were told that FEMA was there, and so as the nurses and the physicians went out, And they actually went to this one area where supposedly FEMA was there to take individual people's applications, and they had to stand in long lines. And, you know, the lines opened up really early in the morning, and it was pretty hot there. But there was no water for these folks as they waited in these long lines, and they only had, you know, people could only stand in line for a certain period of time. So really, FEMA says that they were there, but the way people were told to access FEMA was either they could do it online, or they could call, or they could stand in line. Well, there was no electricity. There was no internet services. So really, that didn't make any sense. So really, FEMA was there, but they did a really poor job while we were there in October to really help and be of service to the people of Puerto Rico. So we saw that right off the bat. I believe that we felt that it wasn't, the response was very slow, and really it was almost like they were there, but it was as though they wanted people to come to them as opposed to going out and really doing a full assessment of the various communities. And so for our government to say that they need to have, you know, direct communication with the mayors and, you know, how to distribute the food and water that supposedly FEMA had for them, It was a lot of red tape that was unnecessary. And then you have the USNS Comfort, that is a ship, a hospital ship, that came to Puerto Rico and was ready to go to be of assistance. Again, you had more red tape.
Meanwhile, as his administration prepped for Hurricane Florence, President Trump continued his feud with San Juan, Puerto Rico Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz when he said his administration's response to Maria was an unsung success.
I think in a certain way, the best job we did was Puerto Rico, but nobody would understand that. I mean, it's harder to understand. It was a very hard, thing to do. Because of the fact they had no electric, before the storms hit, it was dead, as you probably know.
The mayor tweeted in response, President Trump's statement about his success in Puerto Rico adds insult to injury. The president's visit to Puerto Rico last year drew negative headlines. He was criticized for downplaying the impact of the storm, praising the low death count just 2 weeks later, not like, quote, a real disaster like Katrina. The coverage of President Trump's visit to North and South Carolina was a little more positive. He toured flooded areas, met with local officials, and visited with victims of the storm and handed out food. The president bewildered the media and possibly a flood victim when he commented on a yacht that had beached in someone's yard. He asked a homeowner, "Is this your boat?" The man who lives there said it wasn't, and the president quipped, "At least you got a nice boat out of the deal." Dana Perino served as White House press secretary under President George W. Bush and is currently host of the Daily Briefing with Dana Perino on Fox News. President Trump is taking a lot of heat for the response to Hurricane Maria. It hit Puerto Rico just 1 year ago this week. What's your take on the criticism as well as the administration's response to the storm?
I really do think that Puerto Rico does bear a lot of the responsibility here, and partly that's because it wasn't like the electricity system was in good shape before the storm. In fact, Geraldo Rivera of Fox News who is from Puerto Rico, had done a lot of reporting down there, said the system was so corrupt and they had shortcutted on building and the types of telephone poles that they used, right, to hang the wires. They went for the cheapest so that they could pocket the rest of the money. That had gone on for so many years that when the devastation of Maria struck, there were already problems. In fact, most of the island didn't have power before the hurricane struck. So I think President Trump is correct to be frustrated about the criticism that is aimed at him. I do think there is an argument to be made that if you don't want to be criticized, then you have to be a little bit more visible and you have to show that you care. And I think that part of that was that criticism comes from him not going down there more than once. And the follow-up has certainly not been one that that lends itself to good press, I would say that. I would also look back to Hurricane Katrina. And the state and local government refused to enforce an evacuation. And by the time they realized how important it was, with the president for several days almost begging them to get people to move, they finally decided to do it, but it was on the Sunday, so they only had 24 hours really to get out before the storm hit, and then the levees broke. That was complete and utter devastation. The federal government learned some things that it could have done better as well. But if you want to see good disaster response, you have to look to that first line, and that first line is city and local government.
What do you think about these numbers, I guess it came out of GW, that the president was disputing?
I think that even in Hurricane Katrina, there are still disputes as to what number. For example, how do you count? Is it the people who maybe they were on a ventilator or something and the power goes out? And for example, like in Puerto Rico, did they die because of the actual hurricane or did they die because of the power system? And if the power system wasn't working well before the hurricane, can the federal government and the president actually be blamed for that? Like, how do you count that? But that person certainly did die in the aftermath after a hurricane. You know, this is a hypothetical that I'm using. So I think that that is difficult. There is no doubt that thousands of people were devastatingly impacted. I think the GW study is as good as any, and it seems very thorough. I also don't think that 3,000 deaths could be blamed on President Trump or for on any one president. A lot of people want to find a scapegoat. He's not it on this one.
Dana, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
That will do it for the From Washington podcast this week. A return to the Senate Judiciary Committee for Brett Kavanaugh. The Supreme Court nominee is expected to answer questions about an accusation he sexually assaulted a young woman when he was in high school. His accuser, California professor Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, also invited to tell her story. Will it upend the nomination? We may know next week. And President Trump heads to the United Nations. We'll review what he said and how it was received by allies and adversaries. Between now and then, the best way to keep up with everything here in Washington and beyond is our Top of the Hour newscast. You can hear it on your radio, the Fox News app, or your smart speaker. For all of us at Fox News Radio, I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.